WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, streaming online at WEFT.org. It's Higher Ground, and I am Eunice Buckner Boone.
I woke up with a jewel. Oh, yeah. Woo. I just turned my hat backwards and I went back in there like I was a man. Woo. Girl, you better not call me no more.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associates, station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
I got something I want to talk about. Y'all listen here. The time has come to air my feelings. Yeah. There's just so much confusion going down. I'm not the kind to be complaining. But sometimes you got to stand out from the crowd. Everyone's got their own opinion.
come on with me, cause I'm going where the fun is. Come on, don't get lazy now. Just a little bit up the road. Just around the bend. There's something going around inside my head. I think it's something I feel.
Started again. So get-
Oh, yeah. Get on up if you're not up. No, get up if you up. And listen to WEFT 90.1 FM Champaign. If you want to, if you're up and you're listening. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, do that. Be mindful and thankful and appreciative of where you are right now doing whatever it is you're doing. And if you're not appreciative of what you're doing, but you're doing it anyway, and it's not something you'd like to disclose, not even to your closest, which is yourself and the source within you that is always present with you, then you might want to rethink where you're putting your efforts and your energy. The music that I started with today was Ray Charles, "Don't Mess With My World." It's my world, your world. And then, what's the name of the group? Cuba Gooding's Dead. Oh, I can't think of the name of the group right now. But happiness is just around the bend. And where is that? The bend is you. We are it. We are the happiness. We're the sadness. We are the 6,000 emotions or more. We are it. Higher Ground. May 17th was my birthday. Yes, May 17th. And May 17th, 1953, was also the year in which Brown versus the Board of Education decision was made. And that had to do with education. And the Supreme Court made a decision that said, okay, at this point right now in the United States of this America, we will integrate our schools and we will make not separate, just separate schools for persons of darker persuasions, but good schools. In 1957, May 17th, nearly 25,000 demonstrators gathered at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. for a prayer pilgrimage for freedom, featuring 3 hours of spirituals, songs, and speeches that urged the federal government to fulfill the 3-year-old Brown versus the Board of Education decision. The last speech of the day was reserved for Martin Luther King's Give Us the Ballot oration, which captured public attention and placed him in the national spotlight as a major leader of the civil rights movement. I think I'm going to play that speech, and I'm also going to play the drum major speech, because that's the theme of my, I think it's the theme of my show. I don't like to use the word show because it sounds like a performance or, well, I don't say I don't like to use the word show, but I'm not performing, as you perhaps recognize over the years. I know that I have intentionally observed the way in which I have evolved or over the years done this radio program. Higher Ground when I'm on, of course, when I'm on, I can only do me when I'm on. My observation of that is that it's been, I prepare every time for my radio show. I spend hours preparing for it. I oftentimes have way more material than I can possibly cover, even when I have a guest. In this particular instance, I don't have a guest for my second hour. But either way, when I am on, it is my turn, and Higher Ground, I must go on. And there's a great deal of preparation in that. And at the same time, prior to preparing for a particular program that I will be doing, I'm already preparing, because what I share with you is what I live. And therefore, it is not so much that I want you to follow my guideline for living because I can only do my own. But what I hope over the years by presenting as I do myself to you is to encourage you to do that for yourself. Not so much to follow what anyone says, to take the fruits from it. And if it's useful to you as a fruit, then you will use it to turn it into something that you can use in a healthy fashion that will build your cellular self. I'm using some keywords related to some of the things I hope to share with you today, cellular self. And feed, you know, your I am. And so over the years, this is what my hope has been. As I sit here, not my hope, but I should say my faith, is that as I present myself as myself to you, in my, sometimes it appears to be, oh, bumbling, rumbling self. But see, that is, I'm not bumbling and rumbling. It's just that we are all uniquely different. And so therefore, we are often and most of the time responding in a spontaneous moment-to-moment fashion. We're not deciding, am I going to take the next step? We take the next step. And usually when we take the next step, if our balance is okay and there are no impediments in the way, then we are generally taking step by step by step without thinking I'm taking the next step by step by step. Sometimes there is a trip in there, and sometimes a trip can be kind of long lasting in a sense that we can feel the after effects, the consequences of it. But it's what do we do with that? That's in the spontaneity. It's always spontaneously moment to moment. So I hope that you will enjoy my company as I enjoy my company with you. That you enjoy your company while you are enjoying my company. So I want to play the drum major speech by Martin Luther King. And you say, oh, it's not Martin Luther King's birthday. Martin Luther King never asked us to do a celebratory birthday for him. This was something that we tend to do after people are dead. We really speak highly of them, and we also speak not so highly of the dead. But the point is, and it reminds me, and it's really poignant, if you had to ever get an opportunity to listen to what the media might say about Kanye West's conversation with Ellen DeGeneres. But I think it's just the way it's reported oftentimes in the media. It has to have this sort of negative slant to it. And perhaps if it didn't have a negative slant, why would we want to look at it? Because the negative slant is that we enjoy bad news. And that, if you hear it enough, you begin to believe that's exactly what we do. And if bad news is happening to someone else, then it's not happening to me, then that's not me. But as we live, we realize that what is happening in the world happens to all of us, whether we want to recognize it or not. May 17th was my birthday. May 8th was the date in which my cousin that was 99 transitioned. And her transitioning to me was seamless. It's as if she left the body, not that she left the body, but whatever that life force that's in all of us, you know, left that body that had actually could not continue. It had outlived its time. It just said time. But up until that point, the spirit, this being that my cousin Arizona showed me when she was living and when we encountered each other, whether it was through telephone conversation or actual presence with me was that you take care of your body because your body is the temple. It's where you're living as an express being happens. And all those sensory and consciousness experiences that we have occur because we have this body that provides us a particular experience. But we realize that we are more than the body itself, because there's this, these invisible, unseen occurrences that happen within us. And so she had a great deal of appreciation for that and believed that it was to be cared for, that all, the source being and the body. And so up until the time she transitioned, I believe that she was not she, because once again, she is just a form. He is just a form. It's an expression, but it is not what it is. It's not all there is. So here I am still in my body. And what I realize, what is so precious to me and to all of us, is that when Martin Luther King said that we all can serve, he was not talking about we can serve because we have a special place to serve. We have a specialness that makes us able to serve. But he said that we all can be servants. And if that's not what we're doing, then what are we doing? So I believe that Martin Luther King, living as my cousins, living in the body, was not my cousin. She was not my anything. We are more than that. And Kanye West talked about this on Ellen DeGeneres' show when he was talking about how Michael Jackson paved the way, Russell Simmons paved the way for him to do the things he's able to do. But you have to be great, in a sense, in order for people to, or in order for us to support one another. We look for ways in which we can not support each other until after we're dead sometimes. You have to be great first, and then people will listen, and then there will be this big support there. But up until that point, you're not great. But I'm different with that. We are all here to serve. So it's important to me that I realize that my life is not mine only to do for myself. And if we see too much in our world, as Ray Charles says, my world, your world, stop messing with my world, and we see the mess, we have to understand that that too is our projections. And if we see what we think is fulfilling and enjoying and wonderful, we must recognize that that's our field, fulfillment, enjoyment too. That is all a fulfillment of our inner manifestation. It's our expression. And when I am here, and whenever and wherever I am, whenever I am, that is me. Not the little me, but the me without the body, without the hair, you know, without the look, without the sound of, you know, just the sound of, okay, where you been, who you know, what you doing, how the kids, your grandparent yet, blah, blah, blah. Not saying these things aren't, they are part of our experience, but they're not who we are. Who we are is what we talk about after the person's dead. What did they mean? What did that life mean? And that's the same life in us. And we get to do that. So when I'm here, I'm prepared. but I'm not following a script. Except mine. Not even a script for me. It's just follow the flow. You know, be here. I'm ready. So I want you to, I think one other time I said to you, take out your notepads and, you know, take a pen and take some notes here. Because we often think about everything is entertainment or either is there just for our listening without thinking about what are we listening to, what are we taking in. And how is what we are listening to and taking in, how is it influencing us or is it not? And how are we influencing that which we are giving out? So everything is really for a, it serves a purpose. It's a purpose. There's a meaning and a life in everything we do. And that's my understanding now more than ever. So be certain that you have a purpose. And if you serve, not serve out of subservience, not serve out of wanting to be the leader, not serving out of wanting to be the first in line, not serve because you want to be great and stand apart from the rest, but because you serve every day, you serve your soul. You serve your soul. So, I want to play Dr. Martin Luther King today. And also, let me put my glasses on so I can see the clock here. Yes, I might even play this TED Talk by Tony Robbins, if I think we'll have enough time for that, because I won't be talking for 2 hours. Well, can I talk for 2 hours? Yeah, I can talk. I think I have something to say now. I think that's what it's all about, right? It's not, and it's not just talking. But anyway, I'd like to play that Tony Robbins, as I thought was really good. It was a TED Talk he did. And it's one of the top 20 TED Talks over the years. And the name of that TED Talk, if we don't get to it, but if we do get to it, it's called, no, not that one. I took notes on this one too. Let's see here. Turning the pages. Oh gosh, where is it? Why we do what we do. That got my attention. Oh, yes. Why do we do? What is your motive for action? And he says that emotion is the force for action. It's not always, you know, the emotion is, what am I trying to accomplish, achieve, or get? It's all, it's in there. But it's the emotion underlying that gets you, propels you to do whatever it is you're doing. It doesn't matter what you're doing. I mean, it matters what you're doing in terms of when you think about it, is value to you, to the larger source, or just to yourself, and no consideration much to how it's influencing other people. But he says it's emotions, and I do believe that. I do believe that. So I want to play that one too, why we do what we do. And let's see, what's the other one I want to do? This one is by Tommy Rosen, How Yoga Brings Ease to Disease. And then Dr. Bruce Lipton, Is Our World Changing Form. He makes reference to a butterfly in its late stages. Well, the caterpillar in its late stages. It's breaking out of its shell because it's fed himself enough that now it's turning into a butterfly. So we are being transformed. Our world is being transformed. Whether we're ready to transform the world at large, we are being transformed individually. And we're seeing that in terms of our political structure too. The presidential race was very interesting, and we might look at it and say, well, it was just, it's so different or whatever, But this is what we're doing. You know, we're actually doing that. And we actually tell people, you know, you have no chance to win. We actually tell one another, we have no chance to win. And yet Bernie Sanders continues, along with all these supporters, all these people are saying, wait a minute, we do have something to say here. It is not okay for you to deny our voting rights. It's not okay for just a few people to have control over many in terms of resources. How much billions of dollars do we need? How much wealth do we need? And it's not just the billionaires and the millionaires and the thousandaires. It's, do we need to see one another in such a limited fashion that we value one another based on what we appear to be, what that person is perceived as by some legacy or by some action or some value or some thing it did. And Martin Luther King talked about that. You can serve. You can serve. That is the message. Two, that is a very underlying message within this presidential campaign. You can, but listen to the message too. You can't. You don't think. You don't reflect on what it is that you're doing and how you're doing. And we only do it at certain times, certain events, certain occasions. No, you're doing that right now. If you're listening right now to Higher Ground, that is what I am sharing with you. This is coming on its own from me, and that which is reaching you, it's coming from you, and you don't have to conjure that up. I have some announcements to make. Okay, doop, 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 doop. WEF Underwriting. Elliott Counseling has 35 counselors providing mental health services for individuals, families, couples, children, and groups. Evening and weekend appointments are often available immediately. Virtually all insurance, including state employee insurance, is accepted. There is also a self-pay sliding scale. You can contact Kevin Elliott or his staff at ElliottsCounselingGroup.com. This is Elliott, ELLIOTT, CounselingGroup.com or 217-398-9066. Yes. And also, who is calling me on my phone? I better turn this off. This is weird. Sorry about that, you all. Whew. I didn't know my phone was still on. But I use it for, I'm going to be using it on anyway to play the recordings. At the Art Theater in downtown Champaign beginning Friday, May 20th, screening daily for a second week is Seeing Street, a story about a boy growing up in Dublin during the 1980s who escapes his strained family life by starting a band to impress the mysterious girl he likes, the Family Fang. We'll have multiple screenings where layered performances from Nicole Kidman and director star Jason Bateman add depth, extra depth, to a sharply observed look at domestic dysfunction. You have three chances to see The Green Room, a late-night fright flick that delivers unapologetic genre thrills with uncommon intelligence and powerful performances on Sunday, May 22nd at 4:30 for free and with a question and answer with the director is Keep On Keeping On, a movie that offers keen observations and infectious warmth that will provide much pleasure for jazz buffs in particular. All righty. Yes, I just want to bring this up, and I've got to stop so that I can play the things that I have promised to play. Parts of Windsor Road to open to test it out. So in your News Gazette today, Mayor Laurel Pressing says Urbana will reopen parts of Windsor Road as a way of testing the pavement that was shut down last fall after showing signs of cracking. So anyway, if you want to read more about that, because I know a lot of us, I know me, I've seen this construction going on for a long time because that's near where I live. And anyway, so Robert and I from time to time talk to each other, and I think to myself, you know, when is this going to be completed? Because it's been redone within the last 10 years twice. This is the second redoing, and then the problems after the newest one. So anyway, c'est la vie. It's got to be done. It's got to be done. What else here? I'm going to do this too. Got to do this. This was a blog on Synapse, and it's written by, what's his name? What is this guy's name? Okay, what is his name? Well, the name of it is called So You're a White Teacher. So You're a White Teacher. Cool, me too. I mean, statistically, it's not that impressive, but still you teach that. You teach. That can be a powerful job. I say can because I firmly believe there's a large chunk of us white teachers who remain silent on issues that matter, not just for our students, but for society as a whole. Institutional oppression, more specifically, institutional racism. When I approached you about this, this is what you said, but I'm white. I don't feel comfortable discussing those topics. But the majority of my students are white. I tried my best not to choke on your words after you whispered them to me. Always a whisper, as if you were committing some crime by talking about race. Gasp. I tried to give you my answer in person, but your eyes glazed over in my presence because I brought up something that wasn't March Madness, NFL draft, or MLB related. My bad. Please forgive me. Allow me to give you those responses again in a format that is unlikely to reach you. But I'm white. What keen perception skills you have. Just for the record, race has never been a black problem in the United States. Historically, the oppressors are, wait for it, white. Gasp. The fact that you are white is only more proof that you should be ready to have these conversations. Chris Rock said it plainly in an interview with Frank Rich. Quote, so to say Obama is progress is saying that he's the first black person that is qualified to be president. That's not black progress. That's white progress. There has been black people qualified to be president for hundreds of years. Unquote. You can check out more of the interview here. When you hide from a conversation behind your whiteness, you are trying and failing to absolve yourself from responsibility. You don't want to feel the guilt trip, as you might call it. The subtext of your words is that it is their problem. It's not. And the solution isn't going to come from one specific racial group in the United States. I don't feel comfortable discussing those topics. That pit in your stomach that forms when you hear the word racism spoken around you, that spike in your heart rate when students ask you what you think about the pervasive racism that still exists in our society, that worry you feel when you get the one student of color from school in your class for the semester, it's your unconscious reaction. It's your learned reaction. I'm not asking you to ignore it. I'm asking you to own it. Actively work against it as a fair thinking human way. Your silence on the topic isn't helping us, no matter how many times you post a meme of Morgan Freeman as your get out of racism free card. This is where Morgan Freeman says, how do you stop racism? Stop talking about it. I'm going to stop calling you a white man, and I'm going to ask you to stop calling me a black man. Morgan Freeman. No one is supposed to feel comfortable discussing institutional racism or any various forms of oppression. You might assume that I feel completely at peace when my class dives into a discussion surrounding internalized racial self-hatred that stems from the widespread institutional racism found in Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye. I don't. But I'm an adult, and part of my job is to demonstrate how an individual addresses personal as well as societal controversy. Quote, I don't feel comfortable discussing those topics, unquote, is equivalent to closing your eyes. Nothing changes and you blind yourself. And when a large portion of society makes a conscious decision to close their eyes, well, you get what you get. But the majority of my students are white. It's hard to keep my jaw from hitting the floor on this one. Let's start with the smaller percentage of students that you don't seem to be worried about. One word defense, differentiation. It pains me to have to bring that up. I'm not even talking about differentiating your teaching to reach all types of learners. I'm just saying that you should probably think about addressing the diversity of your classroom in all its beauty. As for the overwhelmingly white majority, one day, hopefully, they are going to leave this town and go to a place that reflects the diversity of the world more wholly and realistically. Sadly, it won't be the college they attend. When they do so, I hope that we have provided them with an education that prepares them to talk professionally about issues like, you guessed it, institutional racism. A good starting point would be to explain to the white male athletes that no, they can't call each other racial slurs as a form of camaraderie. We need to trust ourselves and educate ourselves enough to have these conversations with students. We cannot tell ourselves that they are too young to handle these conversations. Teach them like young adults, the key word being adults. If you treat your students like kids, then you are going to send a bunch of kids out into the real world. I think we can both agree how scary of a thought that is. Where to begin? Start with yourself. Read and read, and then read some more. And by no means should you limit yourself to the Black experience in the United States. Our history is multifaceted across many racial and cultural lines. And so then he also provides a list of books. I know you probably feel inundated with different types of standards thrown your way as an educator. So please forgive me while I give you one more. I promise this one is more meaningful than the other standards. Teaching tolerance has life-changing and curriculum-altering steps they call the anti-bias framework. You can find some resources to help you get started here and here. None of us are born being comfortable addressing topics like institutional racism, but quite a few of us do gain a leg up by ignoring them while others get stepped on while we get there. I've been in your shoes before. I've said some crazy lines that sounded like clear-cut defense points in my head. Hey, my best friend is Black. But I stopped closing my eyes, and I am hoping that you will too. So this was in Synapse. And the name of the blog was called So You're a White Teacher. And I think it's really good. And one of the reasons why I also appreciated this commentary is because I've noticed more Black Lives Matters lawn signs when I'm driving and in my neighbor, well, nearby where I live. And I know that these homes are not occupied by persons of color. Well, at least I do know that they are not. Well, I have to say I don't know, but I think some of them are not. However, this is my point. I don't want a Black Lives Matter sign on my lawn. No, not because I don't think Black Lives Matter. It's because as a person of identifiable African-American colored Negro being in this country, and I've been with me for a long time, and I know what I look like, and you know what I look like when you see me. That I don't have an issue with my life and my color. I don't. But there are some people that do. And those people are not brown and they are not me, like, you know, in that sense. They're not, you know what I'm saying? So that Black Lives Matter is not for my lawn. It's for those who recognize that they have benefited and that in this country, that is an issue. And it's an issue that is not with me. It's an issue that's with the people who have an issue with it, that have used and historically and systemically used color, gender, or whatever else in order to disenfranchise, to threaten, to kill, to mob, to maim, to deny access to resources that are there for everybody. So I don't need that lawn sign. I don't need it, but I like the fact that there are people that do, because they realize rather than just going and saying, you know, that's not an issue. It's not an issue. They just need to, or this is, and that is, and this has been, and I'm tired of talking about it. Well, I don't want to talk about it because it's really not an issue for me. There are so many issues that are not an issue, my issues, but we make them issues. And so we have to take responsibility for how our silence or how our non-participation in speaking out against these things As Martin Luther King says, we can all serve. And the first person you can learn to serve is yourself. And when you are honest and reflective about how you are living and how you are doing and why you do what you do, the way you do the way you do it, then you will see, we will see, I will see the changes necessary to be made. It's not enough for us to point a finger. It's not enough for me to point a finger at you or anyone when four are pointing back at me. So wherever I am, I can serve. And what I mean by that is that I am serving you now. I am serving the best way I know how, by being me, by being myself. And what I have done before I've come here, before I came here, is I examine, I reflect on me. And I'm doing this consciously and intentionally and all the time. What is my deliverance? What I have inside, what I believe is inside, what I believe is motivated and emotionally, it's an emotional thing that projects out that which is what I think and what I feel and how I act. I'm very aware of that, the power in that. So I like the signs on the lawns, and I think it's a decision that people make individually because that is where they are. And it's not something I need for me because I am African-American in my identification in terms of how I look. And so I don't need to have that sign, but anybody can have the sign who wants it. But now I understand why I don't need the sign for me. Black lives matter. I believe all lives matter. But if we are abusing, oppressing, then we have to pay attention to that. Why doesn't it matter? Doesn't it matter? What gives it? Why is it that way? Let's go a little deeper here. See, that's all I'm saying. Let's go deep here. So I like the fact that they're saying, let's go a little deeper here. Let me look at this. All right, so I'm going to put this on and play as soon as I find it. The Sound of Freedom. This is the drum major speech. This is WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, streaming online at WEFT.org. I am Eunice Buckner Boone, and this is Higher Ground. Martin Luther King, not his birthday, not his anniversary of his death, but I guess if you can link it to something, let's link it to May 17th, 1957, the Pilgrimage March on Washington after the 1953 May 17th Supreme Court decision, Brown versus the Board of Education. So at my birthday, all right, May 17th. Wow. But the message, that's what I want us to pay attention to.
This morning, I would like to use as a subject from which to preach the drum major instinct. The drum major instinct. And our text for the morning is taken from a very familiar passage in the 10th chapter as recorded by St. Mark, beginning with the 35th verse of that chapter, we read these words, "And James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came unto him, saying, Master, we would that thou shouldest do for us whatsoever we shall desire. And he said unto them, What would ye that I should do for you? And they said unto him, Grant unto us that we may sit, one on thy right hand and the other on thy left hand in thy glory. But Jesus said unto them, ye know not what ye ask. Can ye drink of the cup that I drink of and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? And they said unto him, we can. And Jesus said unto them, ye shall indeed drink of the cup that I drink of, and with the baptism that I am baptized withal shall ye be baptized. But to sit on my right hand and on my left hand is not mine to give, but it shall be given to them for whom it is prepared. And then Jesus goes on toward the end of that passage to say, but so shall it not be among you, but whosoever will be great among you shall be your servant, and whosoever of you will be the chiefest shall be servant of all. The setting is clear. James and John are making a specific request of the Master. They had dreamed, as most of the Hebrews dreamed, of a coming king of Israel who would set Jerusalem free and establish his kingdom on Mount Zion and in righteousness rule the world. And they thought of Jesus as this kind of king, and they were thinking of that day when Jesus would reign supreme as this new king of Israel. And they were saying, now, when you establish your kingdom, let one of us sit on the right hand and the other on the left hand of your throne. Now, very quickly, we would automatically condemn James and John, and we would say they were selfish. Why would they make such a selfish request? But before we condemn them too quickly, let us look calmly and honestly at ourselves, and we will discover that we too have those same basic desires for recognition, for importance, that same desire for attention, that same desire to be first. Of course, the other disciples got mad with James and John, and you could understand why, but we must understand that we have some of the same James and John qualities. And that is deep down within all of us, an instinct. It's a kind of drum major instinct, a desire to be out front, a desire to lead the parade, a desire to be first. And it is something that runs the whole gamut of life. And so before we condemn them, let us see that we all have the drum major instinct. We all want to be important, to surpass others, to achieve distinction, to lead the parade. Alfred Adler, the great psychoanalyst, contends that this is the dominant impulse. Sigmund Freud used to contend that sex was the dominant impulse, and Adler came with a new argument saying that this quest for recognition, this desire for attention, This desire for distinction is the basic impulse, the basic drive of human life, this drum major instinct. And you know, we begin early to ask life to put us first. Our first cry as a baby was a bid for attention. And all through childhood, the drum major impulse or instinct is a major obsession. Children ask life to grant them first place. They are a little bundle of ego. They have innately the drum major instinct. Now, in adult life, we still have it, and we really never get by it. We like to do something good, and you know, we like to be praised for it. Now, if you don't believe that, you just go on living life and you will discover very soon that you like to be praised. Everybody likes it, as a matter of fact. And somehow this warm glow we feel when we are praised or when our name is in print is something of the vitamin A to our ego. Nobody is unhappy when they are praised, even if they know they don't deserve it, and even if they don't believe it. The only unhappy people about praise is when that praise is going too much towards somebody else. But everybody likes to be praised because of this real drum major instinct. Do you know that a lot of the race problem grows out of the drum major instinct? A need that some people have to feel superior. A need that some people have to feel that they are first and to feel that their white skin ordained them to be first.
Make it plain today, because I'm against it so heavily.
And they have said over and over again, in ways that we see with our own eyes. In fact, not too long ago, a man down in Mississippi said that God was a charter member of the White Citizens Council. And so, God being the charter member means that everybody who's in that has a kind of divinity, a kind of superiority. And think of what has happened in history as a result. This perverted use of the drum major instinct has led to the most tragic prejudice, the most tragic expressions of man's inhumanity to man. I mean, not only does this thing go into the racial struggle, it goes into the struggle between nations. And I would submit to you this morning that what is wrong in the world today is that the nations of the world are engaged in a bitter, colossal contest for supremacy. And if something doesn't happen to stop this trend, I'm sorely afraid that we won't be here to talk about Jesus Christ and about God and about brotherhood too many more years. If somebody doesn't bring an end to this suicidal thrust that we see in the world today, none of us are going to be around, because somebody's going to make the mistake through our senseless blunderings of dropping a nuclear bomb somewhere, and then another one is going to drop. And don't let anybody fool you. This can happen within a matter of seconds. They have 20 megaton bombs in Russia right now that can destroy a city as big as New York in 3 seconds, with everybody wiped away in every building. And we can do the same thing to Russia and China. But this is where we are drifted, and we are drifting there because nations are caught up with the drum major instinct. I must be first. I must be supreme. Our nation must rule the world. And I am sad to say that the nation in which we live is the supreme culprit. And I'm going to continue to say it to America, because I love this country too much to see the drift that it has taken. God didn't call America to do what she's doing in the world now. God didn't call America to engage in a senseless, unjust war as the war in Vietnam. And we are criminals in that war. We've committed more war crimes almost than any nation in the world. And I'm going to continue to say it. And we won't stop it because of our pride and our arrogance as a nation. But God has a way of even putting nations in their place. The God that I worship has a way of saying, don't play with me. He has a way of saying, as the God of the Old Testament used to say to the Hebrews, don't play with me, Israel. Don't play with me, Babylon. Be still and know that I'm God. If you don't stop your reckless course, I'll rise up and break the backbone of your power. Yes. And that can happen to America. Yes. Every now and then I go back and read Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And when I come and look at America, I say to myself, the parallels are frightening. And we have perverted the drum major instinct. But let me rush on to my conclusion, because I want you to see what Jesus was really saying. What was the answer that Jesus gave these men? It's very interesting. One would have thought that Jesus would have condemned them. One would have thought that Jesus would have said, you are out of your place, you are selfish. Why would you raise such a question? That isn't what Jesus did. He did something altogether different. He said in substance, oh, I see. You want to be first? You want to be great? You want to be important? You want to be significant? Well, you ought to be. If you're going to be my disciple, you must be. But he reordered priorities. And he said, yes, don't give up this instinct. It's a good instinct if you use it right. Yes. It's a good instinct if you don't distort it and pervert it. Don't give it up. Keep feeling the need for being important. Keep feeling the need for being first. But I want you to be first in love. I want you to be first in moral excellence. I want you to be first in generosity. That is what I want you to do. And he transformed the situation by giving a new definition of greatness. And you know how he said it? He said, now, brethren, I can't give you greatness. And really, I can't make you first. This is what Jesus said to James and John. You must earn it. True greatness comes not by favoritism, but by fitness. And the right hand and the left are not mine to give. They belong to those who are prepared. And so Jesus gave us a new norm of greatness. If you want to be important, wonderful. If you want to be recognized, wonderful. If you want to be great, wonderful. But recognize that he who is greatest among you shall be your servant. That's a new definition of greatness. And this morning, the thing that I like about it, by giving that definition of greatness, it means that everybody can be great. Because everybody can serve. Every now and then, I guess we all think realistically.
Yes, sir.
about that day when we will be victimized with what is life's final common denominator. That's something that we call death. We all think about it, and every now and then I think about my own death, and I think about my own funeral, and I don't think of it in a morbid sense. Every now and then I ask myself, what is it that I would want said? And I leave the word to you this morning. If any of you are around when I have to meet my day, I don't want a long funeral. And if you get somebody to deliver the eulogy, tell them not to talk too long. And every now and then I wonder what I want them to say. Tell them not to mention that I have a Nobel Peace Prize. That isn't important. Tell them not to mention that I have 300 or 400 other awards. That's not important. Tell them not to mention where I went to school. I'd like somebody to mention that day that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to give his life serving others. I'd like for somebody to say that day that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to love somebody. I want you to say that day that I tried to be right on the war question. I want you to be able to say that day that I did try to feed the hungry. I want you to be able to say that day that I did try in my life to clothe those who were naked. I want you to say on that day that I did try in my life to visit those who were in prison. I want you to say that I tried to love and serve humanity. Yes, if you want to say that I was a drum major, say that I was a drum major for justice. Say that I was a drum major for peace. I was a drum major for righteousness, and all of the other shallow things will not matter. I won't have any money to leave behind. I won't have the fine and luxurious things of life to leave behind, but I just want to leave a committed life behind. And that's all I want to say. If I can help somebody as I pass along, if I can cheer somebody with a word of song, if I can show somebody he's traveling wrong, then my living will not be in vain. If I can do my duty as a Christian ought, if I can bring salvation to a world once wrought, if I can spread the message as the Master taught, then my living will not be in vain. Yes, Jesus, I want to be on your right or your left side. Not for any selfish reason. I want to be on your right or your left side, not in terms of some political kingdom or ambition, but I just want to be there in love and in justice and in truth.
Well, it ended so abruptly, but the point is, and did you take notes? That's what I'm encouraging you to do, is take notes. What did you get out of this?
But if not.
Uh-oh, not this one. Not this one. It was going to go right to another one. But I'm going to go right to another one, because if I spend a lot of time talking, we won't go to the other one, which is the Give Us the Ballot speech, which was at the May 17th, 1957, in Washington, D.C., and 25,000 people were there. And this was once again in response to Brown versus the Board of Education, was supposed to integrate the schools, which didn't happen. And in fact, wasn't recently an article in a newspaper or on the internet or Facebook somewhere where it was saying that there's segregation? Oh, yes. No, it was an article in the News Gazette about segregation in the Champaign schools or segregations in the United States. Of course it is, because you still have communities that are, you know, predominantly a particular group or et cetera. But we're not just talking about that. What we're really talking about is that it's supposed to be, what is it? We're supposed to be serving one another. And if we're not serving one another, then that means we're serving ourselves. And so think about that. But I'm going to go right into this other one, which is the Give Us the Ballot, so that, and then if we got some time to talk, we'll talk. If not, just take notes. take notes on what inspires you or what motivates you, and what is the emotion that's underlying it, and what is that emotion thrusting you to do? You know, what is it moving you to do? You know, how do you want to use that emotion to make a difference in your life first? Oh, I like the thought when he says about being first. You know, when you're on the plane and they tell you what to do. What do they tell you to do? Renee Angela, who's in the house. What do they tell you to do when you're on the plane?
They tell you put the mask on yourself first.
Right. Now, of course, you know why they say that, right? Renee Angela?
Yeah, because if you can't save yourself, you can't help anybody else.
Okay, so if you're thinking in terms of saving yourself, so let's not think in terms of I got to save myself. So you know that if you got to put the oxygen mask on, there's a possibility the plane is probably having some problem, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're thinking about, oh, I got to save my life. Okay, but what about if we're not thinking in terms of symbolism, just look at what does it mean when we take a breath? What does breath represent to us?
The spirit.
Yeah, it represents that, doesn't it?
Yes.
And it's an acknowledgement of what? That I am what?
I am spirit.
Whoa, look at that.
Absolutely.
I'm telling you, see, she's been taking notes.
That's right, I have been.
And right, we are spirit. And so therefore, when we are full, we realize that we are spirit, then there's no reason why I want to deny what?
Breath.
Right, or
exactly.
deny what? My spirit,
exactly,
right? Because that's who I am, right?
Yes.
So if I'm thinking, well, I have to take care of someone else before I take care of me, what am I also acknowledging about the other person?
I'm acknowledging that that person is more important.
Oh, well, you might
say
that.
Their breath.
Okay, but if I think you're more important than me, then there may be circumstances when I think what? I'm more important
than someone else.
Yeah.
Yes.
So let's just stay in the metaphorically. You are breath, and what else is that person over there?
That other person is breath too. That other person is spirit.
Oh, so there's nothing lacking there, is it?
No, it's not.
So if I'm not thinking, I'm lacking and they're lacking, or I have a little bit more than they have,
or they have a little bit more than I have,
then I got to make a decision about whom is going to take the breath. There's only this breath, and only so many of us have access to the breath. But no, that's mm-hmm. not true. We all have what?
Breath.
Right.
We all have spirit.
That's
yes.
Exactly.
We all are spirit.
Exactly the point. So that is what he's saying. That is what I think Jesus was saying, or perhaps Martin Luther King was saying when he says, I don't fear any man because you are just like me. In terms of body, we're all physical beings. We all have the same physical needs, right? We all have this breath in us. It's no different for you than for me. So I don't fear you anymore. You can't do anything that's going to permanently damage spirit or life itself. We can believe that, and that's our projections. That's what it looks like. I can hurt you. I can deny you. I can take away from you. I can take your life or whatever. This is the message. This is what we're sometimes speaking of when we say, oh, I can't put my oxygen mask on first. No, you must put your oxygen mask on in full faith that there is enough breath for all of us. Mm. There is enough resource for all of us.
Yes.
That other way we're also projecting that there's not enough. You're not enough. So if I believe that, then that means occasionally I'm going to think what? I'm a little bit more than somebody else or something else, or that thing is a little bit more than me. So we're not putting that message out.
Mm-mm.
And that's what Martin Luther King was saying. And so they had to kill him. Well, they had to kill the body. You
right.
see what I'm saying? Because that message right there was just too freeing. So that's why Martin Luther King says, you know what, I'm already free. You see, you can't give me freedom. Freedom is already mine. But as long as I think in these kind of slave kind of, lacking, whatever kind of way, as long as I'm thinking that way, I'm running and I'm running, trying to get your approval. I'm running, yes. running, trying to figure out what you like or when you're going to deny me something. when in actuality, you cannot deny me. And if we understood this, if I understood this, no matter what you do, you cannot deny me. You see, so you can do what you do, but you still can't deny me. Things happen, but and we do things to one another, and we see things done to other people or other things. But at the same time, life continues to propel itself. So I continue to propel. My life continues to move forward no matter what the situation is. This is what Martin Luther King's message was. This is what his message is. But that's not what we talk about. We talk about all these other things, these issues, which continue to be issues. He was not interested in color. That was not his issue. It was not an issue for Martin Luther King. It was an issue for somebody, but it was not his issue. But we did talk about it. We talked about it, and we're still talking about that today. So once we understand, and once you understand, as Renee understands, I am spirit. And there's just nothing you can do to that. There's nothing you can do to that. So I'm going to play this Martin Luther King, Give Us the Ballot, which was May 17th, 1957. Oh, my goodness gracious. I was around then. Okay, Renee.
Yes.
Word is out.
Give us the ballot.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, distinguished platform associates, fellow Americans, three years ago, the Supreme Court of this nation rendered in simple, eloquent and unequivocal language a decision which will long be stenciled on the mental sheets of succeeding generations. For all men of goodwill, this May 17th decision came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of human captivity. It came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of disinherited people throughout the world who had dared only to dream of freedom. Unfortunately, this noble and sublime decision has not gone without opposition. This opposition has often risen to ominous proportions. Many states have risen up in open defiance. The legislative halls of the South ring loud with such words as interposition and nullification. But even more, all types of conniving methods are still being used to prevent Negroes from becoming registered voters. The denial of this sacred right is a tragic betrayal of the highest mandates of our democratic tradition. So our most urgent request to the President of the United States and every member of Congress is to give us the right to vote. Give us the ballot, and we will no longer have to worry the federal government about our basic rights. Give us the ballot, and we will no longer plead to the federal government for passage of an anti-lynching law. We will, by the power of our vote, write the law on the statute books of the South and bring an end to the dastardly acts of the hooded perpetrators of violence. Give us the ballot, and we will transform the salient misdeeds of bloodthirsty mobs into the calculated good deeds of orderly citizens. Give us the ballot, and we will fill our legislative halls with men of goodwill and send to the sacred halls of Congress men who will not sign a Southern manifesto because of their devotion to the manifesto of justice. Give us the ballot, and we will place judges on the benches of the South who will do justly and love mercy. And we will place at the head of the Southern states governors who have felt not only the tang of the human, but the glow of the divine. Give us the ballot, and we will quietly and nonviolently, without rancor or bitterness, implement the Supreme Court's decision of May 17, 1954. In this juncture of our nation's history, there is an urgent need for dedicated and courageous leadership. If we are to solve the problems ahead and make racial justice a reality, this leadership must be fourfold. First, there is need for strong, aggressive leadership from the federal government. So far, only the judicial branch of the government has evinced this quality of leadership. If the executive and legislative branches of the government were as concerned about the protection of our citizenship rights as the federal courts have been, then the transition from a segregated to an integrated society would be infinitely smoother. But we so often look to Washington in vain for this concern. In the midst of the tragic breakdown of law and order, the executive branch of the government is all too silent and apathetic. In the midst of the desperate need for civil rights legislation, the legislative branch of the government is all too stagnant and hypocritical. This dearth of positive leadership from the federal government is not confined to one particular political party. Both political parties have betrayed the cause of justice. The Democrats have betrayed it by capitulating to the prejudices and undemocratic practices of the Southern Dixiecrats. The Republicans have betrayed it by capitulating to the blatant hypocrisy of right-wing reactionary Northerners. These men so often have a high blood pressure of words and an anemia of deeds. In the midst of these prevailing conditions, we come to Washington today pleading with the President and members of Congress to provide a strong moral and courageous leadership for a situation that cannot permanently be evaded. We come humbly to say to the men in the forefront of our government that the civil rights issue is not an ephemeral, evanescent domestic issue that can be kicked about by reactionary guardians of the status quo. It is rather an eternal moral issue, which may well determine the destiny of our nation in the ideological struggle with communism. The hour is late. The clock of destiny is ticking out. We must act now before it is too late. A second area in which there is need for strong leadership is from the white northern liberals. That is a dire need today for liberalism which is truly liberal. What we are witnessing today in so many northern communities is a sort of quasi-liberalism which is based on the principle of looking sympathetically at all sides. It is a liberalism so bent on seeing all sides that it fails to become committed to either side. It is a liberalism that is so objectively analytical that it is not subjectively committed. It is a liberalism which is neither hot nor cold, but lukewarm. We call for a liberalism from the North which will be thoroughly committed to the ideal of racial justice and will not be deterred by the propaganda and subtle words of those who say, slow up for a while, you're pushing too fast. A third source that we must look to for strong leadership is from the moderates of the white South. It is unfortunate that at this time the leadership of the white South stems from the closed-minded reactionaries. These persons gain prominence and power by the dissemination of false ideas and by deliberately appealing to the deepest hate responses within the human mind. It is my firm belief that this closed-minded, reactionary, recalcitrant group constitutes a numerical minority. There are in the white South more open-minded moderates than appears on the surface. These persons are silent today because of fear of social, political, and economic reprisals. God grant that the white moderates of the South will rise up courageously, without fear, and take up the leadership in this tense period of transition. I cannot close without stressing the urgent need for strong, courageous, and intelligent leadership from the Negro community. We need a leadership that is calm and yet positive. This is no day for the rabble-rouser, whether he be Negro or white. We must realize that we are grappling with the most weighty social problem of this nation. And in grappling with such a complex problem, that is no place for misguided emotionalism. We must work passionately and unrelentingly for the goal of freedom. But we must be sure that our hands are clean in the struggle. We must never struggle with falsehood, hate, or malice. We must never become bitter. I know how we feel sometimes. That is the danger that those of us who have been forced so long to stand amid the tragic midnight of oppression, those of us who have been trampled over, those of us who have been kicked about, that is the danger that we will become bitter. But if we will become bitter and indulge in hate campaigns, the new order which is emerging will be nothing but a duplication of the old order. We must meet hate with love. We must meet physical force with soul force. That is still a voice crying out through the vista of time, saying, love your enemies. Bless them that curse you. Pray for them that despitefully use you. Then and only then can you matriculate into the university of eternal life. That same voice cries out in turns lifted to cosmic proportions, he who lives by the sword will perish by the sword. History is replete with the bleached bones of nations that failed to follow this command. We must follow nonviolence and love. Now, I'm not talking about a sentimental, shallow kind of love. I'm not talking about eros, which is a sort of aesthetic, romantic love. I'm not even talking about philia, which is a sort of intimate affection between personal friends. But I'm talking about agape. I'm talking about the love of God in the hearts of men. I'm talking about a type of love which will cause you to love the person who does the evil deed while hating the deed that the person does. We've got to love. That is another warning signal. We talk a great deal about our rights, and rightly so. We proudly proclaim that three-fourths of the peoples of the world are colored. We have the privilege of noticing in our generation the great drama of freedom and independence as it unfolds in Asia and Africa. All of these things are in line with the unfolding work of providence. But we must be sure that we accept them in the right spirit. We must not seek to use our emerging freedom and our growing power to do the same thing to the white minority that has been done to us for so many centuries. Our aim must never be to defeat or humiliate the white man. We must not become victimized with a philosophy of black supremacy. God is not interested merely in freeing black men and brown men and yellow men, but God is interested in freeing the whole human race. And we must work with determination to create a society, not where black men are superior and other men are inferior and vice versa, but a society in which all men will live together as brothers and respect the dignity and worth of human personality. We must also avoid the temptation of being victimized with the psychology of victors. We have won marvelous victories. And through the work of the NAACP, we have been able to do some of the most amazing things of this generation. And I come this afternoon with nothing but praise for this great organization, the work that it has already done and the work that it will do in the future. And although they outlawed in Alabama and other states, the fact still remains that this organization has done more to achieve civil rights for Negroes than any other organization we can point to. And certainly this is fine. But we must not, however, remain satisfied with a court victory over our white brothers. We must respond to every decision with an understanding of those who have opposed us, and with an appreciation of the difficult adjustments that the court orders pose for them. We must act in such a way as to make possible a coming together of white people and colored people on the basis of a real harmony of interests and understanding. We must seek an integration based on mutual respect. I conclude by saying that each of us must keep faith in the future. Let us not despair. Let us realize that as we struggle for justice and freedom, we have cosmic companionship. This is the long faith of the Hebraic Christian tradition, that God is not some Aristotelian unmoved mover who merely contemplates upon himself. He's not merely a self-knowing God, but an ever-loving God, forever working through history for the establishment of his kingdom. And those of us who call the name of Jesus Christ find something of an event in our Christian faith that tells us this. That is something in our faith that says to us, never despair, never give up, never feel that the cause of righteousness and justice is doomed. That is something in our Christian faith at the center of it, which says to us that Good Friday may occupy the throne for a day, but ultimately it must give way to the triumphant beat of the drums of Easter. That is something in our faith that says evil may so shape events that Caesar will occupy the palace and Christ a cross. But one day that same Christ will rise up and split history into A.D. and B.C. so that even the name, the life of Caesar must be dated by his name. That is something in this universe which justifies Carlyle in saying no lie can live forever. That is something in this universe which justifies William Cullen Bryant in saying truth crushed to earth will rise again. That is something in this universe which justifies James Russell Lowell in saying truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet that scaffold sways the future, and behind the dim unknown stands God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. Go out with that faith today. Go back to your homes in the Southland to that faith, with that faith today. Go back to Philadelphia, to New York, to Detroit and Chicago with that faith today. The universe is on our side in the struggle. Stand up for justice. Sometimes it gets hard, but it is always difficult to get out of Egypt. But the Red Sea always stands before you with discouraging dimensions. And even after you cross the Red Sea, you have to move through a wilderness with prodigious hilltops of evil and gigantic mountains of opposition. But I say to you this afternoon, keep moving. Let nothing slow you up. Move on with dignity and honor and respectability. I realize that it will cause restless nights sometimes. It might cause losing a job. It will cause suffering and sacrifice. It might even cause physical death for some. But if physical death is the price that some must pay to free their children from a permanent life of psychological death, then nothing can be more Christian. Keep going today. Keep moving amid every obstacle. Keep moving amid every mounting of opposition. And if you will do that with dignity, when the history books are written in the future, the historians we'll have to look back and say, there lived a great people. Yes, a people with fleecy locks and black complexion. But a people who injected new meaning into the veins of civilization. A people which stood up with dignity and honor and saved Western civilization in her darkest hour. A people that gave new integrity and a new dimension of love to our civilization. When that happens, the morning stars will sing together, and the sons of God will shout for joy.
All right. I better put my headset on so I can hear myself talking. All right, so.
These children.
Nope, I don't want that one. Ooh, my goodness gracious. I hope you took notes on that one too. I did not take notes on this one because I was too busy in here talking to my girl Renee. And that was so much fun and is fun. But I'm thinking maybe there's because there are other things I wanted to also share with you. And I'm trying to think which one do I want. Now, Tony Robbins, his talk that he does on TED Talks is so powerful. But I think that you won't hear all of it. That was a really good one. Maybe another time I'll play that for you. But what about this one? How Yoga Brings Ease to Disease. That's a really good one. Let me see if I can find that. Maybe I'll put some music on while I'm looking for it. How about that?
Sounds good to me.
Okay.
Yeah, let me see. The Urbana Park District is doing Yoga in the Park. So,
yeah. So, did you want to?
Yeah, I could talk a little bit about it. Okay. On my Thursday morning show, I had Dana Mancuso from the Urbana Park District.
I've had her on, too.
And one of the things she was talking about this summer is that they're going to have yoga in the park. Mm-hmm. And this is taking place at Meadowbrook Park. I think it's on Fridays from 9 to 10 a.m. And you can bring your own yoga mat or, you know, they have yoga mats. But they have different instructors, like, every week that have just decided. You talked about service. Mm-hmm. Well, the yoga instructors from around the community have decided as a in-kind service that they would provide some free yoga training for the park district and for anyone who wants to become involved. So you can go to the urbanaparks.org and look up yoga in the park and you can find out. I think it starts sometime in like mid-June. I think June 11th is what originally she said. But yeah, so I think that's a great, great service because yoga, you know, helps you relax and center and balance. And I might be out there myself joining up.
All right.
Because it's been a long time since I've done yoga and since my daughter Alex has done yoga. And we've actually really enjoyed doing the yoga and the stretching and just kind of feeling at ease for mm-hmm. an hour. So one of the many great things. So that's wonderful. I love the fact of yoga and helping with this ease because we have so much nowadays with the this ease and just, you know, slowing down. I think that's really what it's about. It's just trying to slow down and try to center yourself and get in touch with that spirit that is within us all, listening to that inner voice and listening to our bodies as well to combat a lot of things. I've learned over the years that listening to my body is the best remedy for anything. If I start to crave bananas, I know that my potassium levels are probably low, so I'm gonna go and eat those bananas. Or if I start all of a sudden saying I need some kale, you know, that might be my vitamin A or my iron levels needing readjusting. And so the body is a phenomenal source of wonder and majesty, and it tells you, because we all have that spirit inside of us that tells us exactly what it is that we need at that moment. And we're able to get it at that moment. So I just love that.
Mm-hmm. And it's really important, too.
It is. Mm-hmm. It's really important to listen to your body and take time out to listen to that inner voice to combat the dis-ease. I like to call it dis-ease instead of disease, because really that's what it is. And you'll find yourself not needing all of these different medications. Not that I have a problem with it, because I take several, but sometimes in those nutrients, it's really, if you listen to your body will tell you exactly what nutrients you need excess of or don't need an excess of. So.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's important. So I found it. Let me see how many minutes this is. Let's see here. How many minutes? Don't stop talking.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll be on tomorrow.
Okay. It's 13 minutes.
Yes, so I'm covering Dr. Underwood's show. So
how's Dr. Underwood?
She is wonderful. She is actually at a wedding this weekend. She's, of course, had a little bit of health problems, but, you know, Dr. Underwood, don't never stop.
No, don't stop.
She don't stop.
Michael Jackson. Don't stop
till you get enough.
All right, we're going to play this one, and I'm going to go out with this. And this is WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM, streaming online at weft.org. Higher Ground, I am Eunice Buckner Boone, and this is a video. Uh-oh, then I lost it again. Let's see here. Where are you? I'm just going to push start. This is on Uplift One. We are one.
Hey, my name is Tommy Rosen. I'm a yoga teacher in Venice, California. I specialize in using yoga and meditation to help people who struggle with addiction. The ways that I see yoga creating a better world are innumerable. I look out at the world and I see people struggling, people suffering with stress, people suffering with addiction, disconnection. And yoga for me is really this force that brings us together, that creates a sense of union, a sense of wholeness, the coming together of mind and body and spirit, the linking of personal finite existence with infinite existence, if you will. Yoga strengthens the body, calms the mind. When I do the work that I do around addiction and recovery, what I notice is people really have this sense of lack. Something seems to be missing, but it's like an itch you can never scratch. You don't even know why you have it, why you behave this way, but you keep engaging in self-harming behavior. Yoga combats that sense of lack by starting to focus a human being on their breath. So you start to develop a sense of connection with the more subtle part of you, your breath, your energy within, even your heartbeat, your pulse, right? So we talk a lot about the building of pranic energy, the directing of pranic energy. That's your life force. So yoga helps us to fill a hole inside of us that takes away that sense of lack. And it all begins with the breath. Another way that yoga helps is by creating a sense of ease in the body-mind system. So we say that addiction is a dis-ease or a distance from ease. So anything you can engage in your recovery from addiction that brings you closer to a sense of ease is going to be an important element of recovery. Yoga is precisely that. It creates ease in the mind-body system. So it's an immediate antidote to addiction. We're living in a time today where there is enormous addiction and stress in the world. We're also living in a time where yoga has exploded in the Western world, really over the last 20 years, if you look at it, but particularly over the last 10 years. And so you ask, you know, why now? Why is this a trend? Is yoga going to come and then go? I don't think so. I think necessity is really the mother of invention. You know, and the necessity right now is people are suffering. They need some relief from the stresses of life. We live in this great information age. I mean, literally, we receive the same amount of information and have to process that information in a single week as our ancestors 100 years ago received in their entire life. Think about that. So we're being bombarded with imagery. We're being bombarded with messaging. We somehow have to process it all. So yoga, first of all, brings us to a point of quietness, of stillness. It's an antidote to the madness, right? We really have to like take it down a notch. And yoga helps us to do that exact thing. So I think yoga is critical for living well in this day and age. It's absolutely a necessity to excel in this crazy information age in which we're living. Seva is the act of selfless service, doing something for someone, or doing something in service to something greater than ourselves, like an ideal such as honesty, or an ideal such as kindness or compassion, that you're doing things and motivated to do things in your day-to-day engagement with the world because of a dedication to a principle that's greater than yourself. So in working with people, often we think, wow, service. We think about someone like Mother Teresa. My God, how could I be that? Could I be that? Should I be that? What if I don't want to be that? What if I don't want to be Mother Teresa, is there another way to be of service, to be in seva in this world? And the beautiful thing that people come to realize in doing service, you get to do service the way you would do it. It would be inappropriate for me to be like Mother Teresa, to follow that particular path. That isn't my path. But I have a unique path of service. I have gifts and ways that I can engage the world with these gifts that are unique to me. So part of my job on this planet is to figure out what are my gifts and how can I engage the world with these gifts in an attitude of helping to uplift and be of service to other people, or service to an ideal that's greater than me. For me and my work, it's how can I help lift somebody out of chronic addiction? That's the question that I want to answer. Yoga and meditation are two of the main elements which for me comprise that answer. Being of service to another person who's struggling in addiction comes naturally to me. Why? Because I have struggled with addiction. I'm uniquely suited to be of service to someone in that way. So that's what I have to do. That would become my dharma. That's my dharma, to be of service in that way. I teach workshops and run retreats around the world for people in recovery from addiction. And addiction for me, I take a very wide perspective on it. So I talk about the big six: drugs, alcohol, food addiction, people addictions like sex addiction or codependency, money addictions like gambling or shopping, and then the sixth is technology. Being connected to our machines in a way that disconnect us from our lives. So these addictions show up everywhere in society, all over. And I use yoga and meditation specifically to bring people into contact with their breath, to help get them embodied. I like to say that we help process the energy of trauma through people, out of people's bodies, through the work of yoga and meditation, breath work. My dear friend Nikki Myers says, we get the issues out of our tissues. So literally it's like that. We're using yoga and meditation to access deeper parts of ourself. I mean that physically, but also mentally and emotionally and spiritually, to process negative energies, to process traumas out of the body so that we can become more present, more effective, healthier individuals, and really start to get on our own unique destiny path, which means the path that we are supposed to walk. In classical yoga, there's really no separation between yoga and meditation. They're actually one and the same. The yoga is simply the state of union that comes through the practice of meditation, actually. The physical process, the physical postures, and what we recognize mostly as yoga in our modern world today is a very small part of the bigger sense of yoga. So we work the body. We strengthen and we stretch. We develop strength and flexibility. We get the kinks out. Why? Mainly so that we can sit for long periods in meditation. Because the yogis, the ancients, knew it was in meditation, in silence and quiet, that was where the download was going to happen. That was where the real change would happen in the individual, that in the sitting. So can we sit still in a state of ease for long periods of time so that we can be in that place of single pointed focus to get beyond the illusion and the pain and the suffering that comes with being attached to our thinking? That's really yoga, is entering the meditative state, which leads you to a place of total union, which is the state of yoga. So I'm looking at yoga from that perspective these days. International Yoga Day is the most exciting United Nations declaration that I've heard, well, for many, many years. It's just an idea whose time has come. To think that we've come to a period where yoga is being recognized on such an international level. It's now obviously global. This is very good news. It bodes very well for all of us. It's such an exciting time to be alive. We've really got in our midst a technology which can solve many of the problems that we have, from internal issues at the level of the individual to the external issues of our world today. Yoga really is that technology that can unite us. Yoga really is that technology that can bring a sense of union and healing to this world now. The fact that the United Nations has recognized it in this way, it will bring a level of credibility to this practice that I think has not been there at the level of international policy before. Super exciting. Wow. The future of yoga involves our children. Let's start there. So imagine 2-year-old, 3-year-old kids actually being taught verbally, but also by example, by their elders, how to sit, how to be still, how to be quiet, how to identify thoughts and feelings within them. The yoga begins at that age. Now, by the time these kids graduate high school, they'll be yogi masters, literally masters. They will have mastered their mind. They will have mastered their body. They will have developed a connection and a reverence for the food that they eat. They will have developed powerful understandings of compassion, and that this world is a world that needs to operate on that principle. They will be able to heal each other and other people just through their presence alone. They will uplift all those they come into contact with, because they will have developed a connection with the inner guide, their inner sense of intuition. They'll become very, very powerful beings. Maybe the types of beings that we haven't really yet seen in great numbers on this planet yet. We may have a few examples in our midst, but the future of yoga, wow. There's no limit to where the human being can get to when we bring these practices into our life, especially from the beginning of our lives. I have a few examples. People that I know who've grown up with yoga, who were shown from a very young age how to do it, how to be still, how to develop a contemplative mind. These people are some of the most creative, most exciting, most life-loving individuals I've ever met. You get around them and it's like, whoa, what happened to you?